People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Stalking is a crime called criminal harassment, according to a Government of Canada webpage. The page says the behavior must give you good reason to fear for your personal safety, and it must have no legitimate purpose. Olivia Peters has been studying stalking, and she says she feels it may be worthwhile to shift focus from fear-based definitions of stalking to ones that focus on how behavior impacts someone's ability to live their life normally. Earlier this month, Peters gave a presentation on her research called Rethinking Help Seeking and Community Responsibility: Canadian Women's Experiences of Intimate Partner Stalking. The event was hosted by AVA, the Alliance Against Violence and Adversity. Today on the program, I speak with Olivia Peters.
So my name is Olivia Peters. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Guelph in sociology. And I'm a criminologist and a sociologist as well. I do a lot of different things. I wear a lot of different hats, but I think that's generally a little bit about me.
And you were sharing some insights from some research you had done at a recent webinar. You talked with 20 people who identified as having experience of intimate partner stalking. What can you tell me about what some of the standout takeaways were from their stories?
Yeah, for sure. So I conducted research on specifically women's experiences of intimate partner stalking and their experiences of victimization and survivorship. There were a lot of really incredible stories and findings that came out of this research and will be published hopefully in the near future. But the main takeaways that I think people would be really interested in are that these experiences, for the most part, while we know about stalking, we know it exists, we don't really have a sense, as maybe people that haven't experienced it, what the lived realities really are and what those main issues that victims face really are. Some of those are that they might not fear for their lives or for their safety. A lot of women do, but that if they don't seem to be fearful, let's say, when they're reporting this either to like informal supports or to formal supports like police or social services, that they are not treated the way that they should be. They are not helped often. So they have to pretend. Some women explained, I had to, pretend to be more fearful than I was in order to get help. So a lot of times they would go, they would say, I'm not able to live life normally. This person is able to basically do whatever they want as far as stalking. I'm having to change everything about my life. I can't go to work or I'm not able to take the same route. I can't go to the same grocery store. I can't take the same path to and from places. I'm always looking out where am I going? You know, I'm not using my social media anymore because I'm being harassed that way. So basically the stalker had free rein over being able to stalk, but police would go, well, you don't seem terribly fearful. And so they wouldn't be afforded any protections, or sometimes, a lot of the times actually, case files weren't even opened, even after repeatedly reaching out. So, not being taken seriously is a huge issue, and so that would be one main thing. Others were around like the normalization of stalking. I mean, women were not taken seriously because they would have people respond with, well, it's not that bad, or, what comes to mind is like, oh, I'm following someone on social media, or right, like that. I stalked so-and-so online. There was one quote from a survivor who said, when people use those terms, they're so bandied about it in our day to day, right? When you say you stalked someone on social media, it usually means you just found a really cute outfit. And so It wasn't taken seriously, even when they would try to talk to someone and say, look, I think something serious is happening to me. So yeah, those are just some of the key findings that were coming out. There's a lot more, of course, but we'll get into it.
Could you give me a sense of what exactly stalking tends to look like?
Oh my God. Yeah. So stalking, when victims were asked to define stalking, they would talk about it being repeated and unwanted behaviors that were meant or intended to cause fear, to manipulate. They're usually used in a way that aligns with what we understand to be coercive control, trying to manipulate and control someone's behaviors. And so in a lot of definitions or understandings of stalking, fear is central to that definition. I don't think it needs to be. And based on this research, it absolutely does not need to be. But stalking can look like in person, following somebody, monitoring somebody, trying to intimidate someone, let's say parking outside of their workplace, that kind of physical monitoring. But it can also be online. And we know a lot of stalking behavior, harassing behavior happens online and goes unchecked. I say to people, you know, how often have you gone to report something on Facebook, report something you've seen on Instagram or whatever, and then you just get one of those automated responses of, we'll look into it. Like, these things just can happen and are allowed to happen. So the online piece can be tracking somebody through through apps, social media, figuring out where they are, who they hang out with. It can be forms of sextortion. So you might have sexually explicit kind of material that you've either created using AI or something like that, or that you have when you were intimate with this person. And you threaten them that you're going to share it with, you know, their family, friends, or colleagues, or whatever, or post online. If they don't comply with whatever the demands are, there's threats. There's all sorts of things that people can do. And so that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg, as it were. But there are so many things people can do, and I think nowadays, living in the age of artificial intelligence, I can't believe I'm saying that. I was born in the 90s, and I think about that all the time. We've come so far, and not necessarily in a great way. with artificial intelligence, there are so many ways that you can stalk and really go unchecked, and that's horrible. So yeah, that's just a little bit of what stalking can look like.
You suggested that right now, if I'm a police officer in one of these situations, my mindset is going to be along the lines of, well, can I lay a charge on someone? And if not, what am I doing here? Can you tell me about that idea?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally understandable that police are operating. I mean, they operate within these strictures of law enforcement. It's a little more black and white. Certainly, police are able to use their subjectivity in decision making to an extent. But what they're really looking at is, do I have the grounds to lay a charge here? What can I do within my capacity as law enforcement? And women generally had more positive experiences with female law enforcement. They were more likely to be believed. We're talking about a very small sample size, keep in mind, but this is giving us more information than we would normally get from a large quantitative and data set, right? If we're looking at stats, it might be X amount of people had positive experiences with police, but we might not necessarily understand, you know, what did that look like? So that's why we're doing this work. Anyway, so back to, you know, this police perspective, if you will, you're looking at whether or not I can lay a charge. You're looking at certainly human behavior. What we know is that police training is very limited as far as intimate partner violence, and that's just intimate partner violence more broadly. So you can imagine stalking has an even smaller amount of time dedicated to it, if any. internationally in police services that have dedicated training or dedicated specialized officers that understand the ins and outs of stalking and what they can do. Their understanding of human behavior in this regard, their understanding of stalking and capacity looks a lot different. So they might not necessarily think, okay, well, if they don't fit the specific criteria, we can't do anything. They might be a little bit more creative as far as, okay, well, maybe I can't lay a charge, but these are the kinds of things I can do. Some examples of creative responses in police here were around the kinds of communication that police might be able to provide with the perpetrators. Being able to address online stalking as well. We don't really have as much of a robust response to online victimization or online stalking as other jurisdictions around the world. So, you know, those kinds of things are really key, really important. And that was based, I mean, women were saying, you know, it's kind of a matter of luck. They would show up, and one woman said she had shown up to the police station. And it was, I think, her third time going. And she said to be taken more seriously, she actually changed her outfit. She worked in construction. She changed her outfit because she said she was not taken seriously wearing her work clothes. And she showed up wearing some sort of suit, I think, or something. And she said she was treated totally differently. And that's a whole other issue. But this person had said, you know, I can't really do anything. Eventually said, you know what, let me get my sergeant. The sergeant came out. And he goes, oh, no, we can absolutely do something. And she said, if I had not pushed and not advocated for myself, that one extra question, that one extra minute of being there, I would have left completely devastated and my life would have been exactly the same, if not worse. So, you know, the other thing I talked about briefly in my presentation was around thresholds and risk assessments. So there are risk assessments that are done for stalking. We have stalking specific risk assessments that have been developed since about 2008, actually based in Vancouver with Dr. Randall Kropp and his team with a psychiatry background. And it's really incredible the kind of assessment work that can be done. It's not to knock assessments, but part of the conversation around them is how are they used, what do they include, and what are the results? And assessments are great, especially for perpetration. For victimization, they assess. I should back up. So risk assessments assess the risk that is faced by a victim and or presented by a perpetrator. It can use these actuarial methods, which we think more of like stats, a checkbox, you're attributed some sort of number. And then based on your score, there's a certain response that'll happen. We have risk assessments for everything, especially in medicine, actually. So there's that. There's also subjective measures that are used in some risk assessments, and then sometimes a combo of both. And so are police using risk assessments? We don't really know at this point based on these experiences, but it seemed that a lot of it was very subjective based on police officers' understandings of what your stalking victim should be like, should act like, and what kind of stalking behaviors you actually can do something about. A woman explained that her ex-partner was parking just far enough outside of her workplace that he wasn't breaching their no contact order. So the police would show up and be like, well, I can't do anything about that. You know, I could maybe ask him to leave, but like, there's no legal grounds for that. So, you know, you get into all sorts of things.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Olivia Peters. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Guelph, and much of her work focuses on intimate partner stalking. Peters gave a webinar earlier this month on the theme of rethinking help seeking and community responsibility when it comes to stalking. Those are among the subjects we've been discussing on today's program. You suggested there that other jurisdictions have more robust systems in place to deal with online stalking. Could you tell me a little bit about what those look like or what we're missing here in Canada?
Oh, yeah. First off, not even just in terms of response, but in terms of our understanding of stalking and what it looks like, other places, and I mean, even the states. Like we don't often think of the states being terribly more advanced than us, especially nowadays given the political climate. But I think one of the main things is that they have a centralized organization that has all this information on stalking. So it provides up-to-date information on your rights as a victim or survivor of stalking of any sort, up-to-date statistics on stalking generally, what's happening, information on what you can expect based on what kind of actions you take. And so we don't really have anything like that. We have information that's based on an RCMP kind of centralized response to online victimization. But even at a cursory glance of this, and a colleague of mine has been looking into analyzing public information, publicly available information on online victimization. Even at a cursory glance, you can see that we don't have tons of information from that. The department itself is small and underfunded, and it primarily focuses on elder or older victims of financial crime. It's a lot of it is financially based, and that's partly because it's easier to track and figure out. Whereas if people are harassing somebody online, it's a little bit more context specific than, oh, a dollar amount was missing or is gone. It's a little more context specific. It is harder to prove as far as who exactly is on the other end. Because certainly people aren't signing their names and providing a signature or what have you. If you are a victim, you go forward and say, this is what's happening, you might very well get a response of, well, we can't do anything about it because we can't definitively prove who it is on the other end that is posting these kinds of things. Other places, police officers will go, well, you reasonably think it's your ex-partner. And based on this information that you've provided, it seems to be the case. So let's move forward with contacting them. And one person said that. A police officer said, sometimes all it takes is a phone call to instill the fear of God in somebody. And sure enough, it was her perpetrator, her ex-partner, lived in another country. And so she thought jurisdictionally, there's no way. But an officer said, no, I'll call him. I'll call him directly if you're okay with that. And he couldn't get a hold of this man initially, but the officer called his parents and said, and this wasn't necessarily a young dude either, but he called his parents because she had their information and explained what was going on. And through that way, he realized, oh, they're taking this seriously. They're looking into it. And that was enough to stop the harassment from occurring. So they didn't need this burden of proof to do something about it. And the doing something about it was informal. It operated outside of any sort of court. So there are some ways that these things can be addressed meaningfully. But again, victims deem this a matter of luck. You have somebody that maybe gets it, and who feels comfortable enough or is trained enough to understand that in their specific role as an officer, they're afforded these, special ways of existing in our world, that they can use those to a survivor's advantage, and can maybe make some meaningful change.
You suggested that rules or systems around this only tend to develop when something really serious happens, when there's a death or a near-death Can you tell me about that idea?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things I talked about is how I called it a catalyzing event. And maybe it's not a word we use often. If you have any background in like high school chem, you've heard a catalyst. A catalyst is something that really generates or expedites a reaction, right? If we think about baking soda and vinegar, put those things together, you're going to have a reaction. And so I use catalyzing event in the sense of talking about how something really horrific generally has needed to happen for major changes, not even major changes, but changes to occur. In terms of cyberbullying, I gave some examples about, Ritea Parsons and these suicides as a result of cyberbullying that occurred. And then you would have a bill that addresses making changes as far as the ease of perpetration or the ways that these things can be dealt with. One example of an event that unfortunately wasn't catalyzing and I think absolutely could have and should have been in Winnipeg, my home city. So this was actually a case that is near and dear to my heart and is there part of the reason that I studied intimate partner stalking. But Camille Runke, her last name is, her unmarried name is LaBurge. And she was married to somebody and ended up separating. But he would stalk her mercilessly. And she was of a socioeconomic status, not to a point where she was able to do things that maybe your average or a lower socioeconomic status person wouldn't have been able to do. So installing like closed circuit television on your property. This was before, this was in 2005 that she passed. So this was before people were having doorbell cameras and stuff like that too. It's a lot more accessible now, I think. But anyways, so she was being stalked by her ex and had contacted police, had taken down notes, documentation of everything that he would do. And he had a history as well of harassing his previous partner. So there are all these things, all these factors that we know to be related to intimate partner homicide and femicide that were occurring. Stalking itself is a huge risk factor for intimate partner homicide and femicide. So there were all these things that were going on at the time. He also owned a gun. That's another risk factor. And she was in close contact with police, installed cameras, was documenting everything. She even printed off photos of him and gave them to her neighbors and said, if you see this person, I need you to call the police. And what was very forthcoming with information to her friends and family about this as well, which not everyone feels comfortable being. And he was able to still murder her, and then he killed himself shortly after. And so here's an event that could have been a catalyzing event, could have been a catalyst for change. And this is a person who did absolutely everything a victim is supposed to do. They contacted people, they documented everything, they raised the alarms. And it still ended up the way that we as scholars have known, based on these risk factors, that it has ended up. Like we know that this stuff happens, but the changes don't happen the way that they should. They don't happen soon enough. There was some information in the news about the family lobbying for ways of tracking or keeping tabs on or tracking stalkers with a known history, so that you do know their whereabouts. She had protection order. She had everything. She did everything she could have done. And And so, you know, there was some lobbying there on the part of her community, but really nothing happened with that. And you won't really see anything, I don't think, past 2015 on that case, which is incredibly unfortunate. So, you know, catalyzing events, there are other examples of this. I think outside of stalking, one example that comes to mind just with a recent mass shooting in the United States is that, you know, in Ireland, or is it? Yes, I believe it was Ireland. When there was a mass shooting, a school shooting, they immediately made changes so that this wouldn't happen again. In the States, we don't see those changes and it continues to happen. It doesn't mean that we don't have the tools and knowledge necessary to stop these things from happening, but that there are other powers at play that allow this to continue. And so, you know, in this case with stalking, we need to make these changes. We need to see, use scholarship, use academic work, research, including survivor stories to make these changes.
You talked in your webinar about some of the ways maybe informally community members are trying to address the issue. You talked about, for example, platforms people might make to share information about, say, people on dating platforms. And you talked about maybe some of the pitfalls that can come with that. What do you think people need to know about that whole situation?
Yes. Community support is integral. There are women, largely women would find that informal supports were a lot more supportive and had a wider range of abilities as far as support than formal supports. So, and they were more likely to go. So informal supports include, it's very formal, but it's your community, it's your friends, your family. It could be your landlord if you're close. It could be your, you know, if you have a church group, a running group, people you just share a hobby with, your neighbors, who, like, just whoever is in your community and your chosen family. And so they are integral for so many people. They are integral to your physical and mental well-being and safety. And this is beyond stalking. I mean, that's just something that we know to be the case as far as people's well-being, is that communities is a big part of that, especially in light of the pandemic, right? That was a big stark reminder of just how important it was to have community around you. And so that's a huge piece of survivorship here. Part of what that looks like as far as intimate partner stalking is an understanding, first off, that stalking does happen and what it looks like. Some people, when they hear it again, it's minimized, it's normalized. They don't really know what it is, or they don't really think it's a big deal. They might normalize, like, well, yeah, sure, they'll find your information online, or yeah, they were able to find where you were in that moment. It's not a big deal. We share information online all the time, you know, things like that. Or it's not that bad. Those are the kinds of things we need to start challenging. And so as a community, taking people seriously and being supportive in your capacity as a community member is integral. And by in your capacity, like, one example that I like to give is of a landlord. People might think, oh, how would a landlord be part of your informal community supports? Not everyone has good experiences with landlords. I get it. But a woman was living on a first floor of a building and said to her landlord she was being stalked but couldn't prove it to police. And part of that was she knew she was being watched through her window by somebody and needed to prove it. The landlord said, you know, like, well, let's come up with some sort of idea, because that you can't be living like this. And so what the landlord smartly, I might add, decided to do was the landlord said, well, you know, like, we're already due for changing things up outside in our landscaping. So they ended up changing some landscaping. There were some rocks under her window. And so they decided, let's take those out and let's put in a flower bed, because that looks completely normal. No one's going to think anything of it. And the sure enough, when that man went to stalk her and watch her and try to take video or whatever of her in her room, they were able to get a footprint in the soil. And it's that, what a creative way of addressing that, right? So there are creative ways within your means, within your capacity, whatever role that is, right? Other people described how their coworkers would look out for them, walk them to their car. They'd be on lookout to see who was parked around the corner or, you know, would actually intervene if somebody showed up and would say, you know, get out of here. Or would say to the person, no, I can't give you her schedule. I'm not allowed to give you any information. So, you know, there are things like that that people are able to do. So community supports are very important. The piece of it that can also be done more broadly, so as far as like online communities through Reddit or Facebook, you know, people are posting information about what has happened. They're asking for advice. I mean, Reddit's a great example of that. It can be a fantastic resource for people, and it's anonymous. But on Facebook, there are these contested pages called Are We Dating the Same Guy? And it's contested because some people are saying it's not ethical to put that kind of private information out there, pictures of guys that are on dating apps and things like that, or sensitive information about real people. But what it has led to are things like you have a registered sex offender who's using an app like Bumble, let's say, a dating app, who should not be allowed to be on Bumble. And technically, it somehow got through, let's say. They made a different profile, they changed their name, whatever. And so someone was able to take screenshots of this and report it and say, if you see this person, you should know this is their history. They are a registered sex offender and they're actually not supposed to be on this app, right? Or they share something and sure enough, find out that this person is in fact married. You know, there's all sorts of stuff. So that's kind of something that sprung out of a community need to protect women, keep them safe. Again, it's contested, but I think it's a really interesting example.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and I'm speaking with Olivia Peters. She's done research into intimate partner stalking. Peters spoke with 20 women about their experiences stalking as part of a research project. The University of Guelph PhD candidate recently presented some of her findings at a webinar called Rethinking Help Seeking and Community Responsibility. It was hosted by the Alliance Against Violence and Adversity, a group that works to address gendered violence. You talked already about the idea that right now in stalking cases, a lot seems to be based on how much fear do people seem to feel, and you think that that's something we should move past. We should not necessarily require people to be in fear. We should instead focus on how is this impacting their life? How much is it forcing them to change their life as far as, you know, their presence on social media, et cetera, et cetera. What kind of frameworks or systems change do you think we need on this issue?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, this kind of comes back to this very gendered, and I think this very gendered understanding of what a victim looks like. We assume, especially a female victim, it's they're going to be fearful, they're going to be meek, they're going to make themselves smaller. Not everybody, first off, man, woman, what have you, like you're not going to show fear in the same way if you are fearful. You may not be fearful at all. And we need to start changing our understandings around what victims look like or what a perfect victim is. You shouldn't have to have any performative element to be taken seriously. And it's okay for women to take up space and be angry about something and then still be treated the way that they should be. You know, to challenge our understandings of what a victim looks like or should or shouldn't, how they should or shouldn't behave. There's research out there that actually shows that fear for stalking generally, but for fear is shown differently among different ethnicities. There was a research study that I talked about in the States that actually showed that Black women did not exhibit fear in the same ways that white women did and Hispanic women when they did a comparison. And so Black women, as a result, were not receiving the same kind of treatment and the same kind of resources. And I think that's a really big finding. Like, it has really big implications as far as how there are inequities in how people are treated. And I don't think that these archaic understandings of victimization are as relevant as we maybe once thought. There's a reckoning of what it means to be a woman who lives life differently and is raised differently in a world where you do worry about or have to be taught about date rape and catcalls and things like that to an extent that men generally are not. They're not socialized for that. And I think that this all ties in. So yeah, when we talk about responses, fear really should be left out of the equation, because regardless of whether somebody exhibits fear in a certain way or says they're fearful and doesn't appear fearful, whatever it is, this is a person who has gotten to a point in their life that they have called you or they've gone to you for help. And that should be enough, realistically. There are other methods and other ways of assessing, you know, the extent to which a person is at risk or what can be done based on who they're seeking help from. We're not just talking about police, of course. This could be a therapist, something in social services, a social worker, victim services, right? But just there are better ways of addressing this. And so I think that's a big reminder that we need to, as a community, as a society, be more creative and not rely on these older standards of response for something that is changing. Like I said, you know, with artificial intelligence and things, and I mean, new apps, our reliance, like how many times have you gone to a restaurant and they've just assumed you have a phone to scan a QR code, right? We just assume people have smartphones now. If I forget my phone at home, which has happened, I was congratulated. I forgot my phone at home because they said, wow, like, when does that happen? That must feel so freeing. And I thought, wow, that really says something about our world, right? We're so reliant on these devices. Like, our world has changed so, so much. So we need policy and action to keep up. I don't know if that answers your question. I feel like there was another piece of that I could address, but.
No, I think it does. I mean, the question was just, how do you think our systems need to evolve around this?
Oh, yeah. As far as systems evolving, I think they need to evolve with the times as far as the kinds of perpetration that occur. I don't know exactly what this is going to look like, but this is partly why we need to come together with people with varied backgrounds and expertise in technology, in law enforcement, in social work, in all sorts of areas, to come together and create these ideas. We tend to avoid innovation in policy and response because there's always a risk, I guess, that things might not work out or that, you know, based on how it's funded, right? We're very conservative in how we approach things. And part of innovating is making they're calculated and researched plans and ideas for response. And I think Canada could be at the forefront of so many things if we were willing to to do them if we cared. And you know, there's a lot more that goes into it than just caring. Of course, you need funding. There's a political climate you have to consider. And there are differences jurisdictionally between provinces, to an extent, and rural versus urban areas, have different issues. So you have all sorts of stuff that's at play. I'm not saying it's not complicated, but I think that generally the spirit of innovation needs to come through in making meaningful change in response to these kinds of more complex social issues.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. Today on the program, we've been speaking about intimate partner stalking. My guest is Olivia Peters. She is a PhD candidate at the University of Guelph. Much of our conversation has been about research that Peters did, which involved speaking with 20 women who had experienced stalking. Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to this conversation today?
my gut reaction to that is yes, of course. There's so much more information out there. I think that, it really depends on what people are interested in knowing. I feel like I have so much, but there are these quotes that stay with me from stories that I've heard. I've done hundreds of interviews in my, again, early career with victims and survivors of domestic abuse, including men as well. And so these stories stay with you, and they're impacting. And I would say, you know, there's one thing specifically about stalking, that a sentiment that I think really encapsulates what it was like for survivors. And I'm not going to do the best job of paraphrasing this quote, but this woman said, you know, he was able to stalk without any consequence. And she basically said, I served his sentence, you know, this whole time. And the lasting impacts on her are omnipresent. They are everywhere. It affected her work. All her coworkers are on high alert too. But it affected the nature of her work and having to put a smile on and just live life normally and try her best, affected ability to parent and what that looked like in her life, her ability to socialize, to even go on dates. And, you know, but she said, you know, I've been serving his life sentence, this whole time. The sentiment of stalking, victimization, basically being a full-time job, being this unfair burden that is placed, and may not necessarily go away. Sure, it changes maybe over time, but that this is something that, if left unchecked, because a lot of it does go unchecked, it completely devastates a person's life and their ability to live life normally. And so one of the key findings really is that, in place of fear, we should be considering a woman's ability, or I guess inability, to live life normally as grounds for protections and protection orders, because that is more accurate to their experiences of that impact. So I would say that's maybe one of the main takeaways from this. I would also say too that I really hope that people, after listening to this, if they've stuck around this long, first off, thank you. But also that they have these discussions with people in their lives. Difference of opinion is a beautiful thing. And one of the issues with social media, one of the many issues, is that we have these algorithms that ensure that we are in these kind of insulated communities where you're in an echo chamber of your own kind of thoughts. Depending on how you vote, how you spend your money, what ads you click on, what kind of content you post, I mean, the algorithms ensure that you're seeing stuff that confirms what you're putting out into the world. And so you have this sense of the way things are. That's not necessarily the case. And so I would challenge people to extend themselves and their curiosities beyond that algorithm, online and in person. Think about how your communities might just be telling you what you want to hear. Seek out difference of opinion and be open to learning, because I think that's one of the most important things that we have in our communities, is the ability to have these really interesting debates and discussions where we are open to hearing somebody else's opinions and experiences, even if they don't align with our own ethos, our own understandings of the world. And so I think that's just a more broad thing I'd like to leave with your listeners, because it does impact all sorts of things, not just intimate partner stalking and your ability to be a great support, but also your ability to continue to educate yourself and educate others, and always be out there learning. And we are all lifelong learners. And I think that being open-minded is one of the hallmarks of that.
Are there any resources that you believe are useful that you can recommend to people on this issue?
That's a great question too. I would say it depends on what they're looking for specifically. However, resources that I think generally might be really helpful, that we have the start of the Canadian Anti-Stalking Association. It started in, I believe, January of 2014. And so there are resources that are being added there. It's in its early stages, but is meant to be a centralized resource. It is the first and only centralized resource that we have for stalking. So I would look that up for sure. It's not just for women, it's for anyone. And so I don't want people to go to a website and feel like it doesn't represent them or that they can't get help. This absolutely is something that affects everybody. And so that's one. Another one would be, and this is just one example. There are definitely other books out there and things that I'm sure would be great reads. But one that I talked about in my presentation was Julie Lalonde's book, The Life and Death and Life of Julie Lalonde. Resilience is Futile, The Life and Death and Life of Julie Lalonde. In it, she details her experiences of being stalked by her ex-boyfriend. And the only reason, and this is such a unique experience, I mean, I had women that talked to me who are obviously kept anonymous, but who talked to me about these really private moments in their life. And all who experience these things by people that still exist in the world. So I have to be very careful with how I share this information. That's a huge part too of why women don't come forward. There are, of course, a lot of reasons, but it has real implications for people that exist out in the world. And Julie, her ex-partner passed away. And so when that happened, it opened up this opportunity for her to share a story that she has every right to be able to share. And so she put it all in a book and talks about the reality of experiencing this, what it looked like for her, experiences with police, experiences with community and her friends and family and their reactions to stuff. It's definitely a difficult, it's not a lighthearted beach read, I'll put it that way. So it would be difficult to read if, because it is, these are harrowing experiences. But I encourage people to pick it up and read it. I know, so yeah, it's a little bit of a plug for Julie's book. I think the French version is coming out soon, actually. So if you're Francophone, you have an option to read in French, which is great. But that's another, so I would look for survivor-based resources through stories. Sometimes people don't know stalking has occurred when they're actually experiencing it. And so reading about it is one of the best ways to learn about it. You read these things and you go, wow, that sounds a lot like my life, or that sounds like my friend's situation. Maybe they should seek help. So those are some things to consider. I'd say those are two great resources.
Olivia Peters, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Olivia Peters is a PhD candidate at the University of Guelph. You can find her presentation on her research into Canadian women's experiences of intimate partner stalking on the YouTube channel, AVA Training.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.